So the topic for tonight's lecture is, does science discredit faith? But in order to answer that well and profitably, we need to be clear what precisely is at stake, or what precisely we're actually concerned with. Because I think that we can ask after this particular thing in a variety of ways and after a variety of forms. So on the one hand, we could simply say, you know, does science embarrass faith? In the sense that, do certain findings of science, which previously the answers of which we had assigned to faith, subsequently reveal lacks or absences or, you know, like false claims, as it were? Another way that we could pose it is science more efficient than faith? If we think about them both as like problem solvers, or if we think about them both as like managerial or bureaucratic or therapeutic, each with its own particular ends, is it not the case that science is better at achieving its ends? A third way, which is what we're actually going to address, is this. Does science displace faith? So we want to pose it in its kind of starkest form. Does it disprove faith? Does it render faith unnecessary? And what I'm going to argue is that it does not. It does not discredit faith, disprove, displace, or otherwise render it unnecessary. And that when practiced properly, these two disciplines, to speak about them in very broad strokes, because each contains a variety of disciplines, that they do not conflict, but rather mutually enrich and inform each other. And the basic idea is that they investigate different things under different aspects with different methodologies. And so they're going to end up being complementary in their investigation of reality. Okay, here's a somewhat helpful analogy to further elucidate what I have thus said. So there is a debate abroad as to who is the greatest basketball player of all time. Okay, like who is the GOAT? And these claims will be proffered in ESPN, you know, talk radio, or in very like kind of vehement forms by perhaps Stephen A. Smith or Max Kellerman, and it causes a great amount of disquietude among the sporting ranks. Okay, so the two big names you hear in this regard are Michael Jordan and LeBron James. Okay, so the question is, who is a better basketball player, Michael Jordan and LeBron James? And I would submit to you that that's a bad question to ask. Okay. That's a bad question to ask. I'm not even going to give my opinion as to whom I think is better, okay? Because I would submit to you that Michael Jordan and LeBron James played in different NBAs, with different opponents, with different teammates, with different playoffs, at decidedly different positions, okay? So now you're going to be like, well, listen, Michael Jordan, 6 finals, 6 victories, 6 finals MVPs. And I would say, that's true. But also, he left to play baseball for 2 years, okay? And I think that should cause him embarrassment, okay? He also retired, and then he came back to play for the Washington Wizards, which I think should also cause him embarrassment, okay? And I think that LeBron James showed up at 8 consecutive finals, and that he almost single-handedly won the NBA in 2015 after Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love had both gone down in the playoffs. So they're just different things. Also, LeBron James is 6'8 and 250, and Michael Jordan is not, okay? So, like, one of them is a football player playing basketball, which is incredible, okay? One is a shooting guard, and one is a small forward. I'm just trying to say, effectively, that these are decidedly different things. And if we compare them into thoroughgoing or rigorous a fashion, we fail to appreciate their respective excellences. They are like apples and oranges. Very excellent apples and very excellent oranges, okay? So I think that we can agree that they are both all NBA caliber players, right? They're up there in the ranks with like Wilt Chamberlain and Magic Johnson. And seamless transition, so too, faith in science. okay, like I said, it's a somewhat helpful analogy. What we're effectively going to do is distinguish the two in order to unite them, okay? So let's proceed apace. First, I'm going to ask the question, what is science and what is its, like, competence? I'm going to be most brief in that because the presumption is that we know, and we're in a room with not one, but 2 periodic tables of the elements, so we should be able to just kind of absorb the answer to that question atmospherically. The second will be to ask, what is faith? And what is its competence, okay? And then we're going to ask, why is there a perceived conflict? And then, is there a conflict? and we will just stick and move, as it is said to Apollo Creed in Rocky II. Okay, so what is science and what is its competence? Here's a little classical background. So science, the word, comes from the Latin scientia, and that comes from the verb scire, which just simply means to know. So the kind of classic understanding, the ancient understanding of science, is that it is knowledge. And precisely speaking, it is knowledge through causes. So science, in its most rigorous sense, is like the fruit of syllogistic reasoning. So you've seen this perhaps, you know, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. You have things contained in premises, and you've, you know, from the premises you adduce conclusions, and you know that with certainty because you can see through the premises to the conclusions. The conclusions are contained in the premises. So here, knowledge is to be distinguished from like doubt, where there are two kind of opposing views between which you are kind of counterposed, or suspicion or opinion, where you're kind of like inclined to the one, but maybe fearful that the other is true. Science is certain because you see, all right? So it's the knowledge born of a kind of vision. And it's also classic to distinguish between speculative and practical sciences. So speculative sciences are those sciences which are ordered towards knowledge, and knowledge alone, which in the modern academic atmosphere, the contemporary university, is something that I think we've lost a little bit of sight of, perhaps, that it is delightful and it is good to know. So again, like in Aristotle's division, he says the speculative science would be like natural philosophy, which begins with the study of motion, and then mathematics, where you abstract from matter and you kind of get to form and figure, and then you abstract further yet, and then you just get to being. Right, wherein all reality becomes transparent to your gaze, and you can just say what is true and good and beautiful, etc. And that discipline he calls metaphysics, right? So the point here is to emphasize that knowledge is something to be delighted in, something that's actually constitutive of the good life. Okay, so like, it's not the kind of thing for which we need ask, to what end? Right? If someone was like, hey, I want to like postmate some boba tea, you'd be like, to what end? And that person could easily respond like, because it is the kind of thing in which the good life consists. And by asking that question, you show yourself foolish, right? So too, there are certain things that are just constitutive of the good life, right? So like, for instance, worship. You know, like you don't worship for further ends. It's not like, I'm going to go pray so that I can be a saint so that my friends can think I'm cool. It's like, yikes. Right? No, you worship because God is worthy. And again, that's the type of thing in which the good life consists. Contemplation, the consideration of what is and what is true. Because our minds are the types of things that are made to be conformed to reality. Because our minds are potentially all things, and we can take what is out there and have a kind of intentional form of it in our very being, such that we can play host to all kinds of thoughts. It's the type of thing in which the good life consists, all right? So, it's just the case that we are this type of creature, right? We are set apart from the beasts on account of the fact that we have minds with which to know and hearts with which to love. And so there are certain things on offer in this world that are just fitting for us, because we are just like one big open wound of intellectual desire, and we will not cease from exploration until such time as we have found something satisfactory, right? So speculative sciences are just good in themselves, okay? Speculative are distinguished from the practical sciences. And here, we're talking about the kind of pursuits of knowledge that are for the sake of some further action. And among the practical sciences, in the classic conception, you would class like ethics, right? So it's knowledge of moral things in order to act well. Or like politics, it's like ethics writ large, as it were. For the sake of the well-functioning of the social polity. And we could also add in here all the practical arts. So art is just the virtue in Aristotle's understanding, which informs your fashioning of things, right? So whether it be blacksmithery, if that's a noun, or, you know, cobbling, if that's a noun, right? These things are the type of things that terminate in goods made, right? So they have a further fruit beyond the knowledge. So it's good to, like, know how to make shoes, but ultimately, you're a good cobbler if you make good shoes. We don't, like, judge him or her by his intentions. It's just like, oh my gosh, those shoes are horrendous. You wouldn't say like, but they were so well-intentioned. It's like, still horrendous, right? Okay. All right. So this is a kind of classical background to science. But when we talk about science, the kind of science that might, may or may not discredit faith, we typically envision it as modern science, right? Now, in order to get from the classical conception of science to get to the modern conception of science, a lot of times you'll pass through a kind of genealogy. So you'll visit these different philosophical touchstones, whether medieval or late medieval or early modern, in order to explain the philosophical background of the scientific revolution. And there are many ways that you can do that. I've chosen just two thinkers, and I know this is a reduction, I know this is overly simplistic, but it's just helpful to kind of zoom in on what I think will ultimately be fruitful for our conversation. So, you have heard of René Descartes and David Hume, who lived like early 17th century, and what they are doing in their particular context is reconceiving inquiry in light of advances in science and the perceived failure of older forms that older forms of Aristotelian science that had kind of governed the practice of science in previous generations. And their principal preoccupation is with knowing that we know. Okay? So in the classical conception, this does not vex most thinkers. So like St. Thomas, for instance, in his first way, which he says is the most evident way of proving God, he just begins with the observation that, quote, motion is evident to the senses. So he just takes sense experience and he grants it. And for him, that doesn't represent like a kind of logical leap or a naive move. He just thinks, again, we are the type of creatures that recognize what is on offer, and we don't need to get hung up about that. But in subsequent generations, and you can kind of paint an historical picture as to why this might be the case, it becomes urgent and necessary to ground that we know what we think we know. So here, the discipline of epistemology, which is the study of knowledge, and then the sub-discipline of criteriology, which is the grounding of knowledge, become paramount, right? So for like Descartes, he wants to reconceive of all knowledge from a kind of interior methodology of systematic doubt. Right? So he calls everything into doubt and tries to rebuild up a vision from the structure of his own thinking. And then in the case of Hume, he tries to do it all based on sense impressions. So what do I actually get in a sense impression? And how can I use that to ground a new epistemology? So with this comes a new understanding of what is rational, or rational probity. Like what actually obtains, and what can I take as proven or as given more fundamentally? And these insights will kind of filter into scientific praxis. And you'll often hear like those who are indebted to Descartes referred to as quote-unquote rationalists, and those indebted to Hume referred to as quote-unquote empiricists. Right. But here are some summary points which I think we can glean from the kind of general tendency on offer. First, natures and causes are inadmissible concepts for scientific inquiry. What do I mean by that? Natures. Okay. So when we say that something has a nature, we mean that it is this kind of thing, right? So I'm a human person, which means that in Aristotle's understanding, I'm a rational animal. In one of his alternate definitions, which I love, I am a non-feathered biped. Oh, yeah. If you ever want to like impress upon one of your friends how much you esteem them, you know, like you just want to like communicate their depth of value and worth, be like, you are a non-feathered biped. They'd be like, wow, I'm touched. Right? Because we're like birds, except we don't have feathers. Okay, so I am this type of thing. I am a rational animal, which is to say that I have an animal nature, okay? So I see, hear, taste, touch, smell things, and I collate that sense experience, and then it begets desire, right? It begets a kind of appetite, and I'm inclined to those things that build up my nature. So because I'm a substance, just because I am anything, I want to keep being that thing, right? But also because I'm an animal, I want to build up my bodily life, right? I want to keep existing, and I also want a hand on life. So I'm ordered to the procreation and education of children, which is like the most sterile way of saying that I want to have a family, right? So, but then on account of the fact that we have intellectual capacities, right? Our minds are not satisfied with one knowable thing, right? Like you go to your math class, you go to differential equations, and they're like, this is the case. And you're like, wowzers, awesome. I need know nothing further. Right? That doesn't happen. You're like, tell me more. Tell me more. Did he put up a fight? To quote Greece. No, you like want to know more and more things because the object of our intellect is what is universally true. True in every regard, not just one kind of true thing or one instance of a true thing. We want to know what is truly true. So too, our hearts are ordered to what is universally good, right? So we're not satisfied with one good thing. You don't go to like Café du Monde and you say like, I'd like some delicious chicory coffee and three beignets absolutely devastated by powdered sugar such that I can't see their contours. And they're like, okay. And then you eat it and then you're like, I will never eat again. No, like 12 minutes later, you're like, could I have three more, please? Right? That's just the nature of our heart. I mean, our stomach is a kind of pale indication of the nature of our heart. But we are not satisfied until such time as we find something we can really hang our whole heart's love on that can bear the weight. Okay? So because I am this kind of thing, there is a pattern for my unfolding. I am to be treated in one way and not in another. I am to desire certain goods and not others. Right? So because I am this, I ought to do that. Okay? And whenever we're describing something that has a nature, we can form of it a kind of causal picture, right? We want to describe not only what it's made out of and how it exercises agency, but what makes it to be what it is and what makes it to be ordered in the way that it is, okay? But with the kind of philosophical preamble to the scientific revolution, natures, on the one hand, are set aside because that's not observable, that's not testable. It doesn't have the same kind of rational probity. And causes, certain causes, are also set aside. Specifically, what Aristotle would refer to as formal cause, the cause that makes a thing to be what it is, in the case of the human person, like a soul. And then final cause, that is to say, its end, towards which it is ordered, which charts for it the course of its unfolding. Okay? So what happens is you dismiss this comprehensive causal picture because you despair of it in a certain sense. I can't know these things because of how I've chosen to take measurements and how I've chosen to build up my epistemology, all right? So what you effectively do is bracket formal and final causality and just take only what is given to sense impressions. And as a result, science is reduced to the measurement of forces and of stuff. So you got forces and stuff. Not bad, but it's just a little bit clipped in its inquiry. All right, so that's the first. Natures and causes, inadmissible. Second, strict delimitation to the material and the sensible. This is kind of the fallout from the first, right? But you can think here of Descartes, who's kind of famous for his approach to, what animates us and how does our soul interact with our body. The theory is often referred to as substance dualism, right? So there are corporeal things and then there are thinking things. And we have to find a way in which for those things to interface. So Descartes is somewhat famous for saying that they interface at a particular place in the brain called the pineal gland. And we downstream can be like, ha, 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 I scoff at his simplicity. But we still labor, many moderns labor under the weight of the same notion, right? There are thinking things, if you will even admit them, right? And then there are corporeal things, and we need to find an interface point, okay? I would recommend at this juncture the lectures of one professor, Jim Madden, who teaches at Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas. If you go on whatever your podcast app and pull up the Thomistic Institute and just search Madden, M-A-D-D-E-N, he has talks about neuroscience and the soul, and they're awesome. Okay. So what you get as a result of this distinction and the kind of reduction to what is material is a mechanistic idea or a mechanistic conception of nature. So you have some of these incredible drawings from the 17th century, some of which I think appear in Descartes' books, maybe in the Principia, where you have like ducks and then you see the interior of the ducks and there are like flywheels, right? So this is part of his corpuscular theory, that we're all basically machines. And that in order to fine-tune a machine, it's just a matter of attending to the parts. So to explain a corporeal thing is just to explain the parts and the relation among parts. So we don't need to ask the question as to, like, what's different between a rock and a plant? Namely that, like, one lives and one doesn't. It's like, for them, that's a kind of uninteresting question, right? Because for them, the soul, once you get kind of further afield, to thoroughgoing materialists, the soul is an inadmissible concept because it's an occult claim. It's like Christians like have this black box of all types of theological notions and they just kind of shake it up and reach into their grab bag and they're like, the soul, you know? Right. So, that's the second. Strict limitation to the material and the sensible. Third, there is a new standard. So I described, in glowing terms, speculative sciences. Well, downstream of the scientific revolution, there is far less esteem for the speculative, okay? Modern science generally resists the distinction between the speculative and the practical. If I were to put this more pejoratively, kind of more pointedly, I would say that it fails to draw a clear distinction between them. So take it as an example, like, what gets funding, right? What gets funding? If you're pitching a grant to the National Institutes of Health, are you going to say, like, I want you to pay a lot of money for me to learn about the human body? And they're like, okay, tell me the name of the drug and what disease it cures, right? They want results because they're accountable, and the national government, you know, esteems results. So the reason why a lot of money is parceled out to research institutions is for the development of drugs or vaccines or discoveries that could be potentially fruitful for our maintenance of health or our enjoyment of life or whatever kind of ends are held in mind. But as a result of which, science is almost, is made util in a pretty wholesale fashion. I'm going to read to you from Descartes' Discourse on Method. Picture him. He describes in one of his first discourses that he kind of comes up with this while sitting in his dressing gown and wearing a sleeping hat. Okay, so just picture that. All right, it's kind of like Dickensian. It's like, is he like a 19th century British novel? Okay, so here we go. Descartes from the Discourse on Method. But as soon as I had acquired some general notions in physics and had noticed, as I began to test them in various particular problems, where they could lead and how much they differ from the principles used up to now, I believe that I could not keep them secret without sinning gravely against the law which obliges us to do all in our power to secure the general welfare of mankind. For they opened my eyes to the possibility of gaining knowledge which would be very useful in life, and of discovering a practical philosophy which might replace the speculative philosophy taught in the schools. Through this philosophy, we could know the power and action of fire, water, air, the stars, the heavens, and all the other bodies in our environment, as distinctly as we know the various crafts of our artisans. And we could use this knowledge, as the artisans use theirs, for all the purposes for which it is appropriate, and thus make ourselves, as it were, the masters and possessors of nature. This is desirable not only for the invention of innumerable devices which would facilitate our enjoyment of the fruits of the earth and all the goods we find there, but also and most importantly for the maintenance of health, which is undoubtedly the chief good and the foundation of all the other goods in this life. Okay, so that's our first point, just to describe what is science and what is its competence. So we have this kind of classical understanding that it's ordered towards knowledge and a distinction between the speculative and the practical. And then we saw that at the dawn, the kind of philosophical dawn of the scientific revolution, that problems in epistemology and criteriology, and then a subsequent kind of materialistic reductionism, lead us to a more kind of wholesale utilization of the sciences, such that they produce fruits. So what we have now, the praxis of modern science, is largely goal-oriented. The scientific method, with its insistence upon hypothesis and experiment, standards of verifiability and falsifiability, have this in mind, okay? And as a result of which, you know, we have what we have. So this is not like me demonizing modern science. It's very good at producing the fruits that it produces. But what I do want to bring to light is that it has bracketed part of the philosophical picture that was formerly, proper to the sphere or domain of science. Okay, so keep that in mind and we'll come back to it. Here we go. So now let's talk about faith. Quote, George Michael. Okay. So Aristotle and St. Thomas and different knowledge claims. Brief background. So we said that there is doubt, whereby you are kind of posed between two options. There's suspicion or opinion, where you are inclined to one but fearful that the other option might be true. So you have like kind of probable cause or probable knowledge. And then there's knowledge, where it's knowledge through causes. You have a kind of vision of the thing. Now, faith is to be distinguished from all of these things, because faith is knowledge through testimony. Faith is knowledge through testimony. So let's draw a natural analogy. My first natural analogy was somewhat helpful. I would like to think that this one is more helpful, okay? I'll make no mention of LeBron James or Michael Jordan, though I am tempted to. So what percentage of our knowledge is verifiable? What percentage of our knowledge is verifiable? Think about this. Is Moscow where the cartographers say it is? I have not been there. I have not been on the International Space Station. I have not gazed on Moscow. I have never been to Moscow. But I think that it is where they say it is. So too, the periodic table of elements. I have never done the scientific work necessary to isolate all of those. Although, in chemistry, I did learn a very helpful mnemonic for remembering the first 20. Hahi, wait, Libibignafni, Namigal Sipskalar, Keka. What's up? Okay, so, but I have no way of verifying that those are accurate descriptions. I rely upon the scientific guild to communicate their atomic number and atomic weight in accurate fashion, right? It's just, I have no idea what electron clouds look like. It's like, okay, right? So we can spell out further and further things. I don't actually know that Michael Jordan, darn, I did it, that he won the NBA championship and was the finals MVP in 1991, 1992, 1993, 1996, 1997, and 1998. But I believe that NBA.com and BasketballStats.com are accurate in their representation of his many fantastic achievements, right? Okay. He averaged over 30 points per game for his career. Can you imagine that? That's like devastating. Everyone was all pumped when James Harden did it for like 27 games in a row. He averaged that many points. Wow. Okay. So, but I wasn't there. I wasn't there when Steve Kerr hit the game winner, you know? I wasn't there for the flu game. You know, so I'll rein it in. So, but I know these things, right? I know them because I have knowledge through the testimony of others who have no reason, it seems, to deceive me. Okay? And if I were to call all of those things into question, I think that would be grounds for committal, right? It is not sane to distrust the testimony of so many, right? So we can rely upon this kind of guild mentality in life, or the general veracity of most people, or just the fact that they are publicly verifiable to some people, and that there would be considerable uproar if lots of people were lying. Okay, so I would submit to you that general, in a natural sense, it is part of human flourishing to believe. Okay? It is part of human flourishing to believe. Let's say that I am going to take a long hike this summer. Let's say I'm going to California, to the Sierra Nevada. I'm going to hike the John Muir Trail. It's like 221 miles long, and I have to get like a guidebook. And I have to trust that guidebook about permit issuing, about water sources, about fire laws, about places where I can send my food ahead of time and pick it up. Because if I don't trust those people, then I'm going to carry like a billion pounds on my back, and I'm going to break a lot of laws. So I'm just flying out to California now because Rebecca Wenk wrote a book called Hiking America's Most Beautiful Trail, and I trust it, because otherwise it would not sell so well on Amazon.com, okay? The Amazon Guild would just devastate her, right? I can't imagine the comments. Okay, so it is part of human flourishing to believe. Now, let's ratchet this up. Let's talk about faith in a supernatural setting. Okay? So, a couple of definitions. Hebrews 11:1, this is the classic definition of faith. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. The substance of things hoped for, that is to say, not yet possessed. The evidence of things unseen, that is, not yet beheld. St. Augustine describes it as to think with assent. The important thing here is that it is rational and volitional. You don't lose your faith. You choose to. Okay? So it's something to which we hold, something to which we adhere. And then St. Thomas will write that it is a habit of mind whereby eternal life is begun in us, making the intellect assent to what is non-apparent. So it's a habit of mind, all right? We're going to talk about that a little bit at length, right? That makes us assent to what is non-apparent. Okay, so what is it that we actually believe in faith? I've said that it's knowledge through testimony. It is knowledge through testimony. All right, so it's classic to describe kind of the reason for which and then the what. So what is the reason for which we believe, and what is it that we believe, okay? Ultimately, in a Christian context, the object of our faith, what St. Thomas refers to as the formal object, is first truth speaking. Okay? What we believe ultimately is that God speaks truly, or there is nothing true. Now that sounds like a little bit absurdist, but let's walk it back. Okay? God speaks truly, else there is nothing true. So, we are relying upon the testimony of God. We are submitting our minds to what He says in such a way that it gives us access to things we would otherwise never know. And then we can talk about the very things themselves that we know. So by this knowledge, by this testimony which God Himself communicates, we know God Himself, and we know all things in light of God. And these things are mediated through propositions. So like this is the purpose of the creed, right? That by the creed, these different statements concerning God, concerning the Trinity, and concerning Jesus Christ actually communicate a knowledge which informs our minds such that we have living contact with the things described. Okay? So again, propositions. So like in the creed, I believe in one God, Father the Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. That enunciation mediates a concept which actually points to a reality such that by assenting to it, I have living contact with the reality itself. Okay? This is big. It's awesome. Okay. So we believe because God speaks, and then we believe what He reveals, namely Himself, things in light of Him, all right? And He communicates that through propositions. So, what's in the Catholic understanding, faith actually inheres in us. It actually changes the composition of our nature, right? So that our nature is elevated. So it's healed, it's purified of the ways in which it's fallen, and then it's elevated such that it can attain to a height that otherwise wouldn't be achievable. Okay? So we are kind of like prisoners of our nature in a certain regard. Don't take that in too dark of a sense, okay? But we are limited to knowing only what we can know. We're the kind of creatures that learn through sense experience. So we're limited to the ambit of what we can actually take in. But by faith, things unseen are revealed in a way that previously we would not have had access to. Okay? So it is an intellectual habit of mind. That is to say, it actually grows our capacity for knowing. So it doesn't truncate it, it doesn't adumbrate it, it doesn't otherwise hurt it, wound it, you know, despoil it of its proper dignity. It actually brings it to its full flourishing. It brings it to its term. Return to our natural analogy. We wouldn't know about the location of Moscow unless we believed. We wouldn't know about the periodic table unless we believed. We wouldn't know about the 1991 NBA Finals unless we believed. So too, there are other things besides Moscow, elements, and basketball. Right? There are things of yet far greater import. Okay? Now, just to return one more time to this fact of first truth speaking, the very motive for which we believe is because God reveals, and that is the foundation. You can't get away from that. Sometimes people want to soften it because they think it sounds fideistic. But here we want to, again, insist on that natural analogy, insist on the fact that it's actually ennobling to believe what lies otherwise beyond our grasp. Okay? So, like, for instance, St. Thomas will say, if I assent to most of the articles of the creed, but I don't assent to one of them, I don't actually have the faith. Why? Because I've held all of those other articles because they square with my sensibilities, and I reject the other because it does not. I have not accepted any of them on the testimony of God. This is the whole kind of, problem with cafeteria, quote-unquote, cafeteria Catholicism. We can't pick and choose because either God is trustworthy or He is a liar. And therefore, to be dismissed, shunned, vilified, hated, right? So either it is true or it is not. Pretty stark, but exciting. Okay. And I would submit to you, this is last point on faith, that all of this hinges on the fact that we have a supernatural destiny. Okay? If there is a God, and if there is a heaven, there is only one who can testify regarding it, the one to whom it belongs by right. And if He can reveal, then it seems most sensible that we would listen. Right? If all there were simply our limited experience of natural life, then it wouldn't make sense to admit this testimony. But even if we have the faintest intimation that there is a beyond, we have caught a whiff, you know? We have just a vague sense. It is worthy of inquiry. Okay. So there you go. That is to describe science in its respective competence and faith in its respective competence. Now, the question could be entertained, Well, why then is there a perceived conflict? Okay, because what I describe doesn't necessarily seem conflictual. So why is it that there is so much made of a perceived conflict? Okay, one I would submit to you is exegetical. There are exegetical reasons for this. Exegesis is just the word that we use to describe like reading of a text, interpreting a text, and it's often applied to scripture. So how we read scripture, how Christians read scripture, can sometimes be scandalous for the scientific community. Okay, so for instance, like young earth creationism. Some people will say that the earth is like 6,000 to 8,000 years old, and that dinosaur bones, which can be carbon dated to whatever, like the Cretaceous period, are placed there by God as a test of our faith, right? I'm not making fun of anyone in particular, and I don't mean to be like flippant, but that's crazy, you know? That's crazy. But when you say that, people assume that that is the tenet of Christianity, and therefore all Christians are loons, right? And so the scientific community has a notion of Christianity that is very much associated with just like a kind of small subset of fundamentalism, and as a result of which, they dismiss it all to court, okay? So that's the one, without going into it at too much length. The next is historical, okay? So they offer, it seems, historically, conflicting comprehensive narratives. So in their respective spheres, faith and science both have aspirations to describe all of reality, right? And we've lost the capacity to understand how two things can do all. Right? We think about it in competitive terms. We think about it in materialistic terms. So if one claims to explain everything and the other claims to explain everything, then they must be in conflict. But it's more like, for Aristotle levels out there, it's like form and matter. You know, something can be composed wholly of its stuff and wholly of what makes it to be thus and such. Right? So, you know, like you have the notion that both are comprehensive conflicting narratives, okay, both aspire to account for all of reality, and then people are naturally led to conclude that one accounts for all of reality better, right? So, like, science has a very evident explanatory power, it has a very evident predictive power, and it has a very evident instrumental power, right? Like, what's the last disease that faith cured? You know, like the wry respondent says, like, well, Jesus cured plenty of them, you know, and then the, you know, disaffected scientist says, well, like, bottle that and sell it. You know, when we think about it in terms of the utilization of something for the purpose of the maintenance of health or the general enjoyment of the fruits of the earth or the easing of suffering, science has a lot of things in its corner. Okay. And then on the flip side, faith has a number of embarrassing moments in its history. So people often point to like Galileo. Here's a great word that I love. Obscurantism. Right. That the faith is against progress. Right? It's somehow against the advancement of knowledge for fear of what it might let in. Okay? That's a kind of short sketch of historical things. There's more that we could go into there, but to pass to the philosophical. I think it's important to notice that praxis produces first philosophy and that first philosophy will sometimes slide into ideology. Okay, Father Gregory, you said a lot of fancy things. That was real cute and wildly unhelpful. Okay, again. So praxis, like how we practice a science, actually informs how we think about the whole world. Okay? So everyone has a first philosophy. Everyone has fundamental commitments, even if they don't want to admit them. That's something actually, it's kind of wild about an ironic age, is that a lot of us are content to slough off all fundamental commitments for fear of being found dopey. I don't know if you've noticed that, but like in a culture where irony and snark is the common, you know, discourse, it's very difficult to find out what people actually love, you know, and especially if it's your friend, you're like, how do I love you? What do you care about? You know? Okay. So that's a sidebar. But each praxis has a first philosophy. So if we're constantly ironizing, we become the type of people who are hollowed out, desiccated husks of former humanity. Okay. But if you practice science by bracketing form and bracketing finality, then you end up kind of dismissing those from your worldview, and then you tacitly adopt a first philosophy, which will not permit them to function. Okay? So everything, again, just gets reduced to force and to stuff. And that can get really deeply philosophically entrenched. Okay? And then it just informs how we think about everything. So, like, we look at the periodic table, and most of us think, like, ah, yes, these are the most fundamental building blocks of reality. But truth be told, like a lot of these things were made in a lab and they are exceedingly unstable. You know, they've only existed for like microseconds and then they blow up. Okay? That does not sound to me like a fundamental building block of like reality, right? What fundamental building block do you have that spontaneously combusts? If your Lego set included such fundamental building blocks, your life would end tragically at the age of 8, okay? So, like, the fundamental building blocks of things are, like, rock, carpet, spike, tree. You know, like, these are the fundamental things which are composed by yet more kind of basic elements, but they're not necessarily stable, right? Okay, but we think about our world atomistically. We kind of balkanize everything that we see in such a way that it just becomes what it is. Okay. Another example of this is evolution. So we admit evolution is a valid scientific theory, right? And we try to square that with our Christian faith, which it can be done. I recommend another thing. Thomisticevolution.org. Awesome. It's super sweet. It's like this really eloquent description of Thomistic philosophy and theory of evolution in a way that makes Christians breathe a sigh of relief. You're like, I don't have to cut off my head. Okay. So, but oftentimes readers of evolution think that because this is the case, then all things just are by chance. That is not necessarily so. And again, I recommend the book, Thomistic Evolution. Okay. Or like, you're an anthropologist or you're a sociologist and you think like social conditioning just means that we don't have free will, right? So we are easily influenced. People have sympathetic accent. Yankees come down to New Orleans and all of a sudden they start talking like you and you're like, you are a shill and a liar. Get out of my face. You know, it's like, no. I mean, like, he was trying, kind of, but he just didn't do it that well. You know, like, and he'll go back to New York and he'll feel embarrassed and he'll try his best again. You know, like, just because we change in different social atmospheres doesn't mean that we are without free will entirely, okay? So, and then once we've, so I said that praxis gives rise to first philosophy, and then first philosophy can just kind of slide into ideology, right? And this is where you get entrenched materialism, just kind of scientism, where science can only supply, or science is the only thing competent to supply explanations for all that's on offer, or like positivism, which is a cool 19th century wild scientific, you know, heresy that like it's a like effectively like religion evolves into science. It's like, ooh, say more. Okay, so that's just again brief sketch. I'm trying to just raise as many questions as possible, so that way the question and answer session can just be a maelstrom. Okay. So fourth and finally, is there a conflict? Answer, no. Okay. Comes as no surprise. But let me say a couple of things that will be more helpful. So St. John Paul II says, what we need is a more mature attitude and a more accurate grasp of the authority proper to the church, enabling her to better distinguish between the essentials of the faith and the scientific systems of a given age. Okay. So what we're effectively saying is that faith and reason, or faith and science, are compatible, okay? So the kind of underlying Christian, Catholic, or just, you know, perennial philosophic approach to reality is that reality is out there, and our minds, our judgments are true to the extent that they are actually conformed to what is, okay? So this is the standard for what is. I am confronted by the fact that I cannot move this podium easily, nor can I deconstruct it with any ease. I won't try, you know? And so as a result of which, I know that I can lean up against it with a kind of certainty. So too, like, even if I am the most world-denying philosophical cynic or skeptic, I'm not going to, like, you know, hop out in front of a bus passing through campus, right? Because in the marrow of my bones, I know that what's out there is out there, and that I have to conform myself to what is, okay? Shockwave. Mach 5. So, faith and reason, then, are just two modes of describing what is, all right? One gives, like, access is given by God to what is in a more comprehensive way, and then in another, the methodology imparts to us a real power to describe, predict, utilize, and otherwise instrumentalize nature for our purposes, okay? And I would submit to you that the supposed incompatibility comes as a result of methodological error, okay? It just comes as a result of methodological error. It's people who are operating outside of their competence, right? So Dawkins, you know, great scientist, bad metaphysician. And we can say that, even if we are not as philosophically astute as he is, because by virtue of the faith, whereby our minds are broadened to a yet more embracing reality, we can make judgments regarding what is and what is not. So, like, say, for instance, you study, you know, I said, like, humanities, right? You have, like, classes on utterly useless things like Dante and Chaucer, right? And someone comes up to you and they're like, evolution, X, Y, and Z, concrete particulars, you're out of your league, and you stink, and Christianity's false. You can be like, I have no idea what you're saying, but I know that I'm right. And it's not because I am, like, haughty or arrogant or, like, overly swagger-filled, although those things might also be true, okay? It's because God speaks truly, else there is nothing true, right? And so if there is a perceived conflict, there is either bad science afoot or science operating outside of its bounds or bad interpretation of the faith, right? And we need to be honest and humble when that is the case, okay? So the human spirit is ultimately ordered to wisdom, an all-embracing understanding of reality as a whole in light of ultimate causes, especially in light of the end or goal of all things. And this entails an attentiveness to reality in all of its dimensions and the working of human persons firing on all cylinders, both those of faith and of science. The final word goes to Cardinal Avery Dulles. Science can purify religion from error and superstition, while religion purifies science from idolatry and false absolutes. Thank you. So I'm delighted to entertain questions if you have any. Yes?
I agree with you that science and faith do not conflict. And you define science and you define faith, but you didn't define God. And you say God speaks truly, and I believe that. But we have to think of that with some humbleness. So how do you define God?
So excellent question. I'm going to give you an exceedingly cagey answer and then a straightforward one. Okay. So in St. Thomas's Summa, in the first part, the first question is devoted to methodology, and then the second question is devoted to whether God exists. And this is classic for an Aristotelian science, is that you would first establish the existence of the object of your inquiry, and then you would try to define what it is. Okay. So that second question is super famous, because question 2, article 3 is where the five ways get trotted out. So Thomas establishes that God exists. He does so with clarity, and he does so with conviction. And then, in the prologue to question 3, when he should advance to the question, what God is, he says, we cannot know. Rather, we can say, how God is not. Non quid sit sed quomodo non sit. And so he begins with this kind of like epistemic humility, in the sense that what we are doing here is a kind of delimiting of the mystery. We can rule things out. We can say what God is not. We can purify our concepts from idolatry, right? But ultimately, we rely on God to reveal himself, okay? So like when St. Thomas now proceeds through these next questions, he says God is simple, which amounts effectively to the fact that God is not divided. It's a negation. He says that God is perfect, which is to say that God lacks nothing proper to himself. Again, a negation. God is good. God is infinite. God is eternal. God is immutable. God is, and all the things that he is saying is effectively ruling out from God imperfection. He's ruling out from God things that are proper to our human way of knowing and existing. And so when we talk about God in like a philosophical setting, which is, I think, basically what I've said before kind of getting into the question of the fact of revelation, what we are trying to do is rule out what ought not be said, right? But then in the Christian understanding, we add to that the fact that God reveals himself, right? In the first, you know, in the covenant with the Jews, and then in the fulfillment of that covenant with the revelation of Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son of God in the flesh. And then that becomes decisive for our knowledge about God. So like, for instance, in the Old Testament, God is only really ever spoken of as Father like maybe 11 times, okay? Old Testament, by comparison to the New Testament, is like 4 times as long, okay? In the Gospel of John alone, Jesus refers to the Father something like 119 times. So it seems that Christ has come for precisely this purpose, to reveal God, such that you can look on the face of Christ and in a certain sense, see the face of God. And from that, we draw our certainty. And so when we make claims regarding certainty, it's always in this kind of personalistic context. That's not to say that it can't be communicated, right? And it can't be translated. But it does mean that to have faith is ultimately about hearing God, right? So like Benedict XVI in the beginning of Deus Caritas Est, he says, being Christian is not the result of an ethical choice or a lofty ideal. It's not something that we kind of devise. Rather, it is an event, an encounter, right, that imparts to life a new horizon and a decisive direction. So we, in that sense, are like receptive passive in a certain regard. We wait on the Lord. And so our humility is kind of like existential reality. It's a factor that goes all the way down. This is tangential, but I think it's beautiful. I was just listening to lectures about Scripture, and the professor was saying that there was a kind of thought abroad in the first century that the Messiah would come when the people of God were ready. But when Christ comes, what does he call this generation? A perverse, an adulterous, and wicked generation. Right? So Christ comes precisely at a time when we are least worthy. As St. Paul says, while we were yet sinners. Right? So there's no real proportion between nature and grace. Ultimately, it's just an atmosphere of gratuity. So we need to wait on the Lord to give himself to us. And our certainty is entirely conditioned by that exchange. So that prevents us from being, you know, arrogant or prideful. Because that's the original sin. Thanks for your question.
Yeah, one in the back.
Yes.
Yeah, so this isn't directly about faith and science. It's more about the distinction you were drawing between that Aristotelian and modern science.
Right.
So usually you might want to say that you can infer from the success of a practice.
Yeah, it's veracity.
To the truth. And so, I mean, if modern science ditches formal causes and teleological stuff and meets with much greater success, then that's probably an indication that there aren't any final causes in nature.
Yeah, that's an excellent summary of an argument that is often adduced in favor of modern scientific methodology. I think where the fallacy in that reasoning enters in is how we define success. So what does it mean to be successful? And I think that the norm is the human person. Because when our science loses sight of what the human person is, then it will often fall into wild excesses or wild deficiencies. And I think that is borne out, you know, like the findings of modern medical science and like the increased incidence of anxiety and depression in this, you know, this generation, for instance. Like, why is it that we find it so exceedingly difficult to cope with modern life? You know, why have we not yet found a way to cure that, you know? And that's not to say anything, you know, like against the medical sciences and the way in which, you know, like SSRIs are used to deal with these particular things. But as we are solving certain problems, we are also creating other ones, right? Like, you can live in a city your entire life and never see the stars. You know, it's like, how has it come to this? So I think there are things that are constitutive of the good life, which modern science occludes, obscures, and brackets. Like, science is not necessarily contemplative. I think astrophysics has it best, right? That's because, like, you wait for, like, 8 years before you can get NASA to actually run your mission. You know, so, like, what do you do in the interim? You crunch a lot of numbers and you look at a lot of stars, right? Which is awesome, right? But in a lot of these particular sciences, we don't necessarily take or approach it with a kind of contemplative wonder. We think about it in these hyper-UTL mode, which I think it introduces a kind of perversion into the human heart. So yeah, I think it all hinges on how you define success. Yeah. There was another hand in the back that I missed. Or maybe not. Yes?
What is the view on the issue of the God of the God? Do you have a religion kind of states the territory from the words encouraged by science, the lens by religious politics. Do you think that is a right approach to trying to resolve the issue of faith and science?
So, that's an excellent question. The God of the Gaps argument generally runs this. So you have primitive science, which has a kind of, you know, explanatory force. It's somewhat attenuated by comparison to our modern standards, but it's pretty good. And then religion will interpose itself to explain what cannot yet be explained. Right? And then, as science progresses, those quote-unquote gaps shrink. And ultimately, you come to a point wherein there is no place for God. I have no need for this hypothesis. Right? But I think that the God of the Gaps is set up as a losing proposition. Because once you have dismissed natures and causes of a sort, and you are left with force and stuff, right? You don't really need anything else, right? Because you have already methodologically excluded that broader, farther-reaching picture, okay? So, yeah, of course, you can explain everything with force and stuff, and you know, Descartes and Newton kind of saw this germinally, and it has played out according to their vision. But I think the God of the Gaps argument fails because it does not have a sufficiently robust understanding of God's causality, okay? So in what way is God a cause? He is not a cause like all of these other, like, feckless material causes that we encounter in our everyday experience. God is a transcendent cause. So God gives all things being. We have to account for the fact that there is when there could not have been. This is one of the favorite questions of Martin Heidegger to ask. Why is there something rather than nothing? Right? Because I can conceive of many things, but that does not necessarily mean that they are, right? So like dodo birds, once were but no longer. Unicorns never have been. I just so happen to be. But all those things are contingent. There's nothing about their nature which necessitates their existence. So we have to account for the fact that they are. And this is St. Thomas's third way. So when we talk about God's causality, it's comprehensive. He makes all things to be and all things to act, and all things are transparent to his gaze. So he's not a weak force, right? I know that's a loose use, but he's not just one of many things involved in the kind of warp and woof of material causes. He's a transcendent cause. He makes them to be causes, right? So I think it's because that we have this deficient understanding of God's causality and this modern scientific paradigm which affords the kind of landscape in which God could be forced out. But I think in that we've already set ourselves a kind of losing scene. And I would recommend a talk given by Father Michael Dodds, D-O-D-D-S, also on the Thomistic Institute podcast. Yes?
So would you say that the universe exists necessarily?
I would not say that.
So in the question of why is there... So in the question of why is there opposed to there being not, how can you... To me that seems... hard to reconcile with the idea of a God if the universe doesn't exist necessarily.
Okay. So, that's a good question, and thanks for asking it. So, different people describe God. This will be our last question, then I'll liberate you, and then you can go. And if you have further questions, you can come up and ask them, and I'll just be here. It's kind of... Okay. So, in the philosophical paradigm in which I work, so God needs nothing, right? And that's not to say, like, oh no, he doesn't need me. I could fall out of existence. Like, don't get hung up on that. So God is his existence. So God exhausts all of being. There's nothing outside of God. And again, don't run like the pantheistic or panentheistic logic here. Just think about it in terms of God, okay? So God exhausts all that there is. He is being. His very nature, his essence is to be. So like Exodus 3, I am who am. I am to be. I am my very being. And he is his intellect. He is his active intellection. He is the object of his intellection. So God's one movement, you know, which is not a movement of need or lack, is his very existence, right? So he wants for nothing. He labors under no deficiency. God was not laid up in his heavens kind of like swooning for fear of how he would spend the rest of his days, right? He has no human-shaped hole in his heart, you know, for which we answer. Rather, then you get back to the question of why did God create? Out of no necessity, as you might have in like Neoplatonic emanation models, right? No, not out of necessity, but because he loves, right? Because God chose to. So I have one friend who, when he says it, like, he puts it this way, like, why did God create? He says, because he thought you might like it, you know? Another way I think of describing it is like, God had a secret too good to keep, the secret of his love. And so our being created, our having been created, is a kind of overflow of divine love. So we issue from God's superabundance and return to it. So the whole drama of human life is to recognize that and then worship, right? To enter into that as a kind of conscious return. So we could not have been. And that, like, has wild and awesome implications, right? So when you think about this in terms of vocation, sometimes people think, like, there aren't enough priests. Right? I need to become a priest because God needs priests. Like, God doesn't need anyone. Okay? Strictly speaking, God could do everything that he wants directly. The reason for which he has implicated us in that work is because he loves us. Because it is far more ennobling to be an agent than to be a mere recipient. He wants to actually involve us in the giving of grace. such that the whole drama of salvation unfolds by human agency under this whole grace dispensation. So it's not necessary, but it's good. So thank you. Thank you very much for your attention.